Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
In 2000, then UC San Diego graduate student Megan MacArthur was selected to be an astronaut and visited with UCSD TV. She recently returned and we caught up with her to learn about her experiences of becoming an astronaut and flying aboard the Shuttle Atlantis on the final servicing mission for the Hubble Space Telescope on this edition of On Beyond.
So Megan, how do you feel? What was it like?
I feel good. You know, it was very smooth. It was very straightforward. The scooter got really nulled out all the rates. It was just rock solid. It was like grabbing something that wasn't moving. So felt good. Glad to have that behind us so the EVA guys can get to work.
Megan, it's a pleasure to have you returning to UC San Diego. I think it was 9 years ago that we met previously, and you had just been selected for the astronaut program to train. And now you have actually served on a mission, the final servicing of the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's a pleasure having you here. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back.
I recall during our previous conversation that one of the things that was very exciting to you was sitting in the final interview board, a room maybe 12, 15 people of the most preeminent NASA personnel at the time. And your statement to me was something to the effect like, right, these people are going to choose me? Now they chose you and you are among them. How does that feel? What kind of encouragement does that build in you? And also, what kind of challenges does that throw down for you?
It does feel really good to have finally achieved that thing that I set out to achieve, to actually fly in space, to be part of a crew, to be on a space shuttle mission, and to have it go as well as it did and to be successful with our mission objectives. It feels wonderful. It's very satisfying, and you know, it was sort of a long time in coming. It doesn't do away with the feeling, though, of I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe they chose me to do this thing. It's still, that feeling doesn't go away.
I asked my 12-year-old daughter if she would have a question for you, and she asked, what is it like being a woman in a somewhat male-dominated, or what is perceived as a male-dominated profession? And she actually wanted to know, how was it working in the male-dominated setting, or quote-unquote male-dominated setting, of actually being on board the STS?
Well, we still have, I would say, around 20% women in the astronaut office, which I think is pretty indicative of the number of women you have in a lot of the sciences that we draw from. So it's representative of the number of people that are applying for the job. I wish it was a lot higher. I wish we had more women coming up, you know, through the sciences and engineering fields into the astronaut office. I think that would be great. So that's my first answer, as I hope little girls see this and think, wow, she looks like she's having a lot of fun. That looks like a neat job. I want to do something like that. And then maybe that encourages your daughter or other young women to pursue science and engineering as a career. But as for how it was for me, I've grown up in sort of traditionally male-dominated fields in aerospace engineering and engineering in general. So you get used to working in that environment. And really, the guys that I get to work with are great guys. You know, they treat me just like they treat everybody else, no differences. And we spent really 2 years together training.
If that middle school age girl asked you what she should do to give herself the best chances of perhaps becoming an astronaut or just to be a success, and you're a model of success, I believe, what would you say? What would you suggest to her?
I think you have to pursue what you love to do, what's fun, what's interesting to you. And don't be afraid to be curious and to ask those questions. But I think the main point is to find out what it is that you love to do and pursue that and pursue excellence in that. Because if you try to pick something that you don't love and try to be really good at it, you're not going to have that passion that drives you to excel. And so it's finding out that thing that makes you spark, that's interesting to you, that you're willing to put in the long hours and pursue excellence that's going to lead to success for you.
In retrospect, and you obviously found something you loved and you pursued it doggedly, assiduously. In retrospect, how or what elements of your education at two University of California campuses contribute to your preparation or perhaps success at becoming an astronaut?
I think the lessons that I took beyond just sort of the solid foundation in science and engineering that you learn in the classroom, the lessons that I took from UCLA and UC San Diego from Scripps are those lessons in teamwork, in solving practical problems, you know, the getting a hands-on experience problem solving. At UCLA, I had an experience like that in an independent study program. And then at Scripps, the experience of going out to sea, working with the team to get all of the equipment together, to deploy the instruments, to take data. And then I had other experiences where I was helping other graduate students do their own research that had nothing to do with mine. You know, they needed help. They needed that team approach to collecting data. And so getting involved in those types of things were really the, you know, a great lesson for me, something that I took with me on to NASA and you know, just keep learning from the people that you work with as a team.
Let's move on to the mission itself a little bit. I recall there was some controversy about actually performing the last HST survey, the Hubble Space Telescope servicing, whether to go through with it or not, if it was a risk, perhaps it was too dangerous. And I recall reports that scientists, astronomers, and astronauts working together had a great deal of influence in changing the mindset or even convincing powers that it was a worthwhile endeavor. And actually making it happen. Can you comment on that? What was that process, and did you take part in it?
I can tell you from my perspective what that was like. I remember actually coming out here to Scripps one weekend for an event and running into a professor who just called me on the carpet and said, why did NASA cancel this Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission? You know, the telescope produces such amazing science. You know, why did NASA cancel that? And, you know, at the time, what we understood about what we would need to fly safely, we didn't think we could do it. And so basically what that is, after the Columbia accident, we didn't want to launch a space shuttle that couldn't, first of all, we spent a lot of time reducing the risk of foam coming off and hitting the space shuttle. We also spent a lot of time investigating ways to repair damage that might occur if foam did come off and hit the space shuttle. And then space shuttles that go to the International Space Station for their mission, if they had damage they couldn't repair, could stay at the International Space Station until another shuttle could be got ready to come and get them. Now, the Hubble Space Telescope is in a different orbital inclination than the International Space Station, and so we physically can't get there from one orbit to another with the amount of fuel that we have on board. And so in order to fly safely, we would need to be able to launch a space shuttle while, you know, right away, basically, in the duration that the original space shuttle had on orbit, which is about maybe, depending on power usage, you know, can be a few weeks. And we didn't, at the time, have that capability. When our administrator, Mike Griffin, came on board, he wanted the community to look at that again because of the tremendous outpouring, if you will, of affection for the telescope and sort of demand that, hey, let's see what we can do. Can we keep this ability to service this telescope while keeping the people that are doing the work safe? And so they had a whole big team, basically, that looked at whether or not we could get two space shuttles ready at the same time, which is not something that we had really done before. And sure enough, they were able to develop a plan where they could have another space shuttle on the launch pad ready to launch within a few days of our launch if we determined that we had damage we couldn't repair. And so they went, basically made it a very a doable scenario, not just on paper, but there was no kidding, another space shuttle on the second launch pad. They had an entire flight plan and a way to come and rendezvous with us, the plan for spacewalks, the plan for us to power down the space shuttle that we would be in. It was a completely viable plan to come and get us if we needed that option. Now, fortunately, we didn't need it, and we came home safely just fine. So there was a lot of effort that was poured into basically getting this mission back on the books. I think that's the essence of NASA, is we have these challenges that seem impossible, but when we're given the direction by the country, basically, to go after something and to do it, you know, that team comes together, and it literally is thousands of people across the agency that pull together to make something like that happen. It's really impressive to see.
So on to the mission. I clearly remember asking you this. It was what you thought of the possibility of sitting atop millions of gallons of volatile propellants. At the point of launch, are you completely absorbed in your operational duties, or does the magnitude of what is going to happen creep in at all? Or are you just too
That's
busy?
A great question. I think you have a couple of hours where you're actually laying on your back waiting. It's actually exceptionally uncomfortable. And so that takes up some amount of your brain power for that amount of time where you were waiting. And so there's some amount of you that's thinking, let's just go already. I'm ready. Let's go. There's also the, as you get closer in, when your duties require you to start monitoring, you really, your training really does take over. And you are, you know, looking at all of the different things that you're supposed to be looking at, thinking about the next stage, what am I going to be doing next? And so when the stack lights, you're definitely ready for it to go. I'm sure there's a millisecond of, you know, wow, this is really happening. But people have asked me, what did it feel like? What did it sound like? And I find that my memory is, I have a very clear visual memory, but I don't remember other things about how it felt, how it sounded, because I was so engaged in looking at displays, thinking about what was happening. We had a master alarm right at liftoff. So we had a piece of equipment that basically had a short. I think the vibration of the launch ignition caused that short to happen. And so instantly at ignition, we had this master alarm, which we trained for that. And we've spent hundreds of hours in simulators practicing those kinds of things. It still gets your attention on the real day because you're not expecting it on the real day. So fortunately, we had four pieces of the same type of equipment, redundant equipment, basically, so we were still good to go to continue. But there is that part of your brain saying, okay, now what next? What else is going to happen? And sure enough, about a minute and a half into the sequence, we got another alarm that was a faulty sensor, but it was showing us that we had a sick engine. Which is not good either. And so you definitely are, you sort of click into your training because you, in this case, we really had to. We had to monitor everything that was going on. And we're communicating with the ground and they're giving us, you know, information and telling us that everything is still fine and good to go. When you're riding the solid rocket boosters and the main engines together is about 2.5 minutes at the start of the ascent period. And then when the solids do drop away, that it's much less violent. It's a very smooth ride at that point, and you have this tremendous sensation of speed and acceleration. I really can't compare it to anything else because nothing else goes that fast. So, but it definitely, you know that you're going fast and you're getting faster. And then as you reach the end of that 8-minute sequence, you are the vehicle is doing what they call 3G throttling, which means maintaining no more than 3Gs, and you feel that. Through your chest, it feels like someone's standing on your chest, and so it's, you know, it's an effort to breathe, it's an effort to move your arms, and that lasts for a couple of minutes. So you can get up to 3Gs, say, on a really great roller coaster, but it doesn't last that long, and so that's an interesting feeling as well. We do practice that one time in a centrifuge before we launch, but it's a pretty unique feeling, and of course we don't have that in the simulator when we're practicing normally, and so that's a unique aspect of the launch as well. That's pretty memorable, but again, hard for me to compare to anything else.
Does the microgravity come on gradually? Do things start floating around the cabin, or?
Microgravity comes on instantly,
really?
Right at main engine cutoff. So you're on your solid rocket boosters and main engines for about 2.5 minutes, and the solids fall back down into the ocean. They're picked up, cleaned up, used again. The mains keep burning up to about 8.5 minutes, and then they cut off. And when they cut off, you float out of your seat. Now you're strapped into your seat, of course, but you immediately float up out of your seat. So you have this, you know, instantaneous cutoff of the engines. You're floating out of your seat in a big, big giant grin on your face. I mean, it all kind of happens at the same time, and it's you're like, I'm here, I am, finally.
Wow. So that sounds like the most exciting 8 minutes that anyone could ever
experience.
It's boom.
It's a wild ride, but it was great.
What? How was that adjustment to transforming into this long duration free fall that you're going to go on for a week or so?
It takes a little while. You have this instantaneous, you know, floating up out of your seat, and then you sort of enjoy it for a second, and then you have this, you know, stretch of work that you have to do. And so I didn't get out of my seat. I'm still in my seat. We have a procedures book, basically, that we're going through to reconfigure the space shuttle to become an orbiter, basically, from a rocket to an orbiting vehicle. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff we have to do to reconfigure. And so there's a couple people that get out of their seats right away. They're taking photographs of the external tank, doing some other things. And myself and the commander and the pilot, we stay strapped in for really a couple of hours while we reconfigure computers and different pieces of equipment. And then once that's done, I could unstrap and actually get out of my seat, get out of my suit, and then, you know, we still have a whole bunch of other work to do. And you really are, you know, if there was any ground to hit, you'd be hitting the ground running. But you have, you know, 8 hours of work to do and about 6 hours before you're supposed to go to bed. And so it's a tremendous lot of work, not a lot of time to sort of float around and think about where you are. After about 4 hours, I started to feel nauseous. that remained until I went to bed, and then when I woke up the next day, I felt great. So your body is going through that transition, and I think it mainly occurs in space. You get pretty quickly used to working in unusual attitudes, meaning that if you were on Earth, you'd have your feet on the floor, but you might go heads down and be looking at a piece of equipment, and that can sort of, you know, spin you up a little bit. So for me, it took about, I'd say, half a day to get used to the constantly falling. And then after that, it feels very natural. And it also takes a little bit of time to get used to moving yourself around in microgravity, because you think, well, I'll just push off this wall to get over to that piece of equipment. And then you push too hard, and then you have to stop yourself again. And so the first couple of days I spent, you know, whacking into things and getting bruised up. And then after a while you realize you just have to, you know, just a tiny fingertip pressure, and that'll get you where you need to go. So there's that little bit of adaptation as well. And then when you return, when you land, there's a bunch of different things going on with your body. You have lost a whole bunch of fluid while you're in space. You get this fluid shift up into your head, and your body starts dumping fluid. So that when you land, if you did nothing, all the fluid would rush out of your head, and you could potentially pass out. And so what we do right before we deorbit, we drink a whole bunch of fluid to replace some of that, and then we wear a G-suit, basically, just like fighter pilots wear, to push that blood as we're getting back into the feeling of gravity, which does come on gradually as you're landing. It pushes that blood up out of your legs and into your upper extremities and your brain, so you stay upright. But it takes about, I would say, 2 days after landing for me to where I wasn't sort of wobbly on my feet, you know, got my land legs back, about 2 days.
Previously, one of the experiences you said you most look forward to was seeing the Earth from space. How was that? What reflections do you have on it, and how did that compare to your expectations?
One of the things that was interesting about the whole experience is that it was so much like what I expected, and I mean that in a good way. I've grown up in a world where people have always been in space, if you will. So the man landed on the moon before I was ever born for the first time. And so I've seen lots of pictures of the Earth from space, from the space shuttle, as well as, of course, a lot farther away. And so it does look like what you expect it to look like. And it's actually the things that are in motion that I think are most remarkable and most new. I remember the experience of seeing lightning on the Earth as we were going overhead, and it was breathtaking. It was like nothing I've ever seen before. Basically, you have these big storm cells, and, you know, lightning would ignite within the cell, and you would see this. I remember it being purple, very vividly purple, this sort of neon purple worm going around inside this cell of a storm, and then it looked like it was igniting an adjacent storm, and the same thing would happen. And you would see this going across the surface of the Earth for hundreds of miles, and it, you know, I could look at that for hours, except we're traveling too fast to gaze at it for that long. And so you would see it go by, and it was just beautiful, and was, you know, hard to verbalize, but really breathtaking. And I think the other thing that really struck me was when you see the sunrise and sunset light up this thin little lens of atmosphere that we have around the planet, and its relative size to the size of the planet, it's so thin. And you see that and you think, wow, that's, it seems fragile, and it seems very delicate, and it's beautiful, you know, when it's lit up and you can see the clouds, you know, in that little depth of atmosphere. But you have this remarkable sense of, wow, we really need to take care of that, because it's taking care of us. You know, we have this beautiful planet and this just very thin layer that's protecting us.
That's all there is. Okay. That's it. Let's move on to some of your training. Did you train on parabolic flights? Did you have the microgravity experience before you?
Our whole class, the class of 2000, we were called the Bugs for the Y2K bug. There were 17 of us, and we went aboard the Vomit Comet, it's called, and basically they fly a parabolic flight path, and as you go over the top of the parabola, you get about 30 seconds of weightlessness. So in order to give you a bigger experience, they actually fly 40 parabolas, and so you get this weightlessness, but then as you pull out of the bottom, then they come back down and they pull out of the dive to go back up again, and then you're pulling a couple G's, and so you go from weightlessness to multiple G's, to weightlessness, multiple G's, and so that can be hard on your stomach, hence the name Vomit Comet. But I really enjoyed it. I had a great time. One of our classmates took a video of people just sort of, you know, flying around. Everyone's, you know, doing Superman and different things. And you don't actually see me in the video, but you hear me giggling the whole time somewhere in the background. So it was a good early taste of what weightlessness would be like.
Did it prepare you in any sense?
I would say it does a little bit, in the sense that, you know, the only other experience that any of us have in weightlessness is underwater. And of course, when you're underwater, you can move your arms and legs to help you move around in space, in air. It doesn't do you any good. You're just flailing. And so learning that, and I think also you do start to learn the need to just push off gently. But of course, that was, I think, something like 7 years ago. So it does, it's a very physical memory, and it does fade, you know, when you haven't done it for a while.
Now, your training was very close to reality. Did you experience anything unexpected or surprising?
We, of course, had things happen during the spacewalks in particular that we weren't expecting, but we had solutions for them ultimately. And so the training even prepares you kind of to deal with the unexpected. So and the ground teams are always there. Mission Control Center is always there for you. And if they don't have the answer in the room, you know, they've got somebody in a back room somewhere that if they don't have the answer, they're going to find the answer for you. So you have seven souls in space, but you have thousands on the ground that are there to help you when things maybe do surprise you.
Now, one of those things I understand was a tough bolt.
We had a couple of bolts give us some heartache, yeah. The very first task of the very first EVA was for Drew Feustel and John Grunsfeld, who were the spacewalkers that day. We're going to remove and replace basically the last functioning scientific instrument on the telescope. No pressure. So they had to remove this wide-field planetary camera 2 and install the new wide-field camera 3. The very first thing, this bolt that they have to release in order to pull the old camera out, was just in there and wasn't coming out. So what they had to do, basically, when they're going to release bolts, they have a torque limiter so they can't accidentally break the bolt. And what they ultimately had to do was release that bolt without the torque limiter. So there was a lot of tension on the ground about, you know, this is designed to shear. And so if it does, that camera's staying in there. We're never getting this new instrument in there. But Drew Feustel, who was the spacewalker who was out there, if you have to have something like that happen, he's the guy that you want out there. He's, you know, he's a car guy and really good with tools and had a really good sense for, because he'd practiced so much how it should feel, how it should react, he was really great at making it work, you know, in kind of an off-nominal situation.
Okay, here we go. I think I got it. It turned. It definitely turned. Yep. It turned. And it's turning easily now. Very nice.
Okay. And Atlantis Houston for EVA, we copied and saw that. That's great news.
You touched on something about the ground support you have, and it's not just the seven souls up there, but the 7,000 behind them figuring out how to work this one bolt. And many hundreds, even thousands of people have spent the larger portion of their lives connected somehow to the Hubble Space Telescope, either with missions or with science programs or reducing data or in some way. And certainly a great deal of all of us here on Earth, all of humanity, have somehow been touched by results from the Hubble Space Telescope. And I understand that you were the last person to have actual direct physical influence on the Hubble Space Telescope. Does that have any special meaning, or did that leave you with a special feeling at all?
That's actually a really good way to put it, because we have sort of a running joke with our crew, you know, who was the last person to touch the telescope? And so we joke about who that was. Now, of course, I'd never actually touched it myself, and the guys, you know, out there with their glove hands were the ones really touching it. But I was the last person to sort of cause it to move, if you will, by picking it up with the robotic arm and then backing away from it, and then the shuttle flies away from the telescope. And I think that all of us, you know, we have some great pictures of all of us sort of crowded around the overhead window getting one last look at the telescope, being that this was the last servicing mission, last planned servicing mission with people to the telescope. But I don't think any of us felt sadness. I think we felt excitement, because it's a whole new telescope, basically. It has, for the first time ever, a completely working complement of scientific instruments. And already the data that's coming back is, you know, better than they expected it to be. And one of the neat things I remember being told about the telescope by some of the project scientists that use its data was that the telescope was designed to answer some specific questions. But they have a list of what they call Hubble's top 10 discoveries. And five of those are answers to questions that were being asked with the telescope. But the other five are questions we didn't even know to ask that the telescope is providing answers for. So to me, it's very exciting to think about the telescope up there just sort of stretching its wings now after the servicing mission and figuring out what it's capable of doing. It's gonna be amazing us for years to come, and it feels really great to have been even just a tiny little part of that process, to contribute something like that to sort of our body of scientific knowledge it's not something I would have ever done on my own if I wasn't a part of this project. So it feels really good and not sad at all.
I clearly remember you commenting that one of your greatest hopes for space exploration, one of the reasons we do this is it's human nature. And it keeps, in a way, it keeps human nature and the drive to explore vital. In your opinion, how does this space program continue to do that, and how best can it do that in the future?
Well, that's a big question. I think that certainly space exploration provides that for humanity in the way that ocean exploration has in the past and really continues to do. But it's that pushing beyond the boundary, the frontier of the known into the unknown that people have always been compelled to do. That frontier for us now is space, is low Earth orbit, really, because we've pushed out to low Earth orbit. We've been to the moon, but we didn't stay there. And so learning how to push beyond that boundary again is where we're going to be focusing our attention, I think, in the near term. I think, I hope that we'll see people on Mars in my lifetime. That would be tremendous. I'd love to meet with school children and say, okay, who wants to go to Mars? You know, I want to hear about it when you get back, because I'm going to be too old. We're not going to get there in time for me to go. But I think that that we will always have that drive as people. We will always have that drive, that curiosity that makes us want to explore the universe around us. Now, we get all kinds of benefits from doing that as a nation and the world, really, in advances in technology. And you can talk a lot about spin-offs. But the real reason that we do it is because we have this natural drive as human beings to push the boundaries of what we know, to explore the unknown, and to answer the fundamental questions about why we're here, you know, how was the universe made, all of those kinds of things. And I don't think we're going to stop asking those questions.
Looking forward, you have achieved what few humans ever will. And what do you think such an experience that you had prepares you for in the future?
You know, it's hard to know what's going to be next. I spent so many years trying to get here to do this one thing, and it feels great. It's very satisfying to have gotten to do it. I don't know what's next. I hope to prepare for a future space station mission that would be a 6-month duration, and that'll be probably a couple years in the future for me. You know, I'd love to go to the moon. If we get people there in my sort of career lifetime, I'd love to do that. If I was to change completely and pick something totally different and new to challenge myself with, I think the other big important problem facing us, obviously, is alternative energy sources. That type of thing, I think, is a very interesting, challenging question for our society, and that, I think, could easily absorb the rest of my life, you know, a problem like that. So that would be an interesting new thing to pursue, but I know nothing about it at this point other than, you know, the average layperson. So in terms of sort of goals that are worth pursuing, those are right up there.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us again. And I do hope that in a couple of years, after you come back from the International Space Station, hopefully that will happen, that we can meet again and you can fill us in on all your experiences.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.